Okay, let's get started. I'm Dan Rundy. I hold the Schreier Chair here at CSIS. I'd say half of my job at a think tank is to stop dumb things from happening. And I would say that what I've been worried about for the last 6 months, my first worry was that there would be a full merger of AID into the State Department. So we did a paper and hold a very well-attended public event on the merger of USIA and the State Department. Many of you, if you haven't seen it, you can Google CSIS and USIA and you'll see what I'm talking about. And we offered that up as a cautionary tale to say, you know, we spent 20 years after the merger of USIA, right before 9/11, saying, why is our public diplomacy broken? Well, I mean, we can talk about why, one of the reasons is that we merged USIA into the State Department. I think it was a terrible mistake. Secretary Powell, when he became Secretary of State, told communications officers that they shouldn't have done it. And so part of our job here at CSIS, has been to try and stop something stupid like fully merging AID into the State Department. Okay, so that's the good news. I think the bad news is, and we did a whole exercise, that you say, what did Dan do on his summer vacation? It was to convene 30 experts and 2 U.S. senators to do a top-to-bottom review, looking at what could be fixed, because I think there's a lot. No one's going to say, I'm not going to say to this group, okay, everything that we do in our soft power is functioning hunky-dory. It's not. There's a lot of broken stuff. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be fixed, but that requires political will, and that requires honesty. And it requires maybe taking on some interest group issues. So I think we got a pretty good consensus document. I think it was, we put together that commission and did all that work in 9 weeks. That's a land speed record in think tank world. I mean, that kind of stuff, you do that in a year. But we did it because it was important to kind of have a real conversation quickly and to affect the conversation, to do so in a constructive way, because we wanted to put constructive things on the table. So my final point is, what I now worry about is saying, well, I've looked at this, doing some reforms, and either it's too politically hard or I really don't want to do it. And so what I worry about is several folks sitting around a table on the Secretary of State's airplane with a red ink marker and a couple of drinks in them and saying, well, we're gonna get rid of there are 70 special envoys, and we're getting rid of 60 of them because 10 of them are legislatively, they're by law supposed to be done, so we won't touch those. We'll go over the 60 because we can just do it, and then we're going to kind of do some sort of a back office merger and call it a day. So, I come back to what I said earlier. I say 50% of my job is stopping dumb things from happening, and so on first glance, you would say, okay, merging a whole bunch of stuff might make a lot of sense, but I would argue that in some instances, consolidation can be less efficient, more expensive, and more problematic, and can greatly hamper the functioning of what we're trying to do. I will make 2 other points, and I'll stop. My view is that AID and the State Department have different cultures. AID and the State Department have different goals, and they have different needs for the kinds of functions that they're supposed to carry out. And so, at first glance, saying I'm going to merge things like HR, or procurement, or financial management, or other functions that are similar are going to, that at first glance, I think we need to be very, very careful. I think there are some things you can do more of together, and that we should explore that as well. So what I've asked these folks to do is to say, okay, what shouldn't we do? Going back to my principle, like what shouldn't we be doing? What fixes can we make? Because I don't think anyone at this table is going to say everything is working just fine. And so what fixes would you make if you were on these committees? So my view is let's work together and put some things on the table that are constructive, because there is a moment and we should take advantage of this moment and we should put some constructive things on the table. So with that, we have a really interesting group of panelists for this conversation that we're calling Increasing Efficiency or Breaking the System. My friend Susan Reichle, who's a former counselor to the administrator at AID, is with us. Dave Eckerson also had the job of counselor to the administrator. Tim Beans, who I remember as running, and Tim ran HR at one point in his life. Tim Beans ran procurement at AID at one point in his life. He was a mission director in Thailand at one point as well. And then we have Brent Schaefer, who's been a lifelong, has had a career at AID on the executive office function. You'll hear more about that shortly. So I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to turn it over to the very experienced and thoughtful group of panelists. Susan, I'm going to give you the first word.
Great. Thanks, Dan. And thank you first for hosting us this afternoon and all of you for your time and those who are online, because I think often we don't spend enough time on this issue of really the operations. And if our operations don't function well, not just within USAID, but obviously within the State Department as well, then we can't achieve our missions. And it's just great to be here with old friends who we pulled together for this little reunion. So just a couple points I wanted to make at the top, and then I know we're going to have a longer discussion. The first is that this is not a new issue. This is something, you know, we've been grappling with both within development and diplomacy for more than 20 years. Because if you look back at the 90s, for example, that was when we started to see clearly a duplication of efforts across all of the U.S. government. It was part of the re-engineering government, if we remember, from the 90s, and that reinventing government, and that led to obviously different departments and agencies taking on the functions of development, everything from DOJ playing a role when Dave and I were down in Haiti in the early 90s to obviously Ag and others and whatnot. So that happened. And then with the fall of the Soviet Union, what we also saw was the creation of a new function as a result of State Department becoming more operational and obviously having worked in the former Soviet Union, having the language skills and whatnot. And that new function was called Foreign Assistance Coordinators. So, and I'm going to just take a moment on that because I believe that's one of the issues that's on the table right now. Should we have, you know, embassies across the board where there's a lot of foreign assistance have a Foreign Assistance Coordinator? And as you know, in the backroom functions then that we had in the State Department, we had the creation of EURACE, we had the creation of MEPI, we had the creation of SRAP, we had lots of creation of different offices to coordinate. Well, when you create these new functions and offices, what it leads to is a lot more work and a lot more process, and particularly for the people in the field. And Dan, you know, highlighted most of our work had been overseas. And so while the new offices and new systems that were created in the 90s and then in the last decade with the creation of the F Bureau for another mega coordination bureau then created another layer. And the ones who really then are hampered by this are the folks in the field. And why we wanted to emphasize that is because as a result of creating new processes and new systems and that duplication, it means we're slower and we're less efficient. And that's something that this administration has clearly made a priority. They want to be more efficient, more accountable, more impactful. And so looking at these different entities that have been created over the last 20 years, you know, really provides us an opportunity to eliminate the duplication. Dan mentioned, and tomorrow there will be an event here at 2 o'clock, I believe, yeah, on the consensus report. One of the things that all the think tanks looked at over the summer, and I was part of the CSIS and then sort of the backroom whisperer to many of the other reports, is that how do we really eliminate the duplication and get rid of the processes that are preventing us from being more impactful? And I would just emphasize a couple things. One, clearly development, USAID being the lead development agency, it's an expertise, it's a discipline. We have the backroom functions, and they're going to talk more about that in order to actually enable us to achieve that mission. But also State Department, their mission is diplomacy. They really became hampered down over the last many years and of trying to be more operational without the systems in place, without having the programming systems in place, such as evaluation and design capability and procurement capability and the management functions that you really need. So I think what we're proposing is that we allow both going back to their core disciplines. We have very different cultures as well. And that brings me really to my last point, which is our cultures. One of the things that we talked about in our task force over the summer and in a July event that we did here is that, for example, the reason why you would not want to merge the HR systems is because we actually hire different people. We recruit different people into USAID than we recruit into the State Department. We need both functions. We need people with development experience, who have master's degrees, who have years overseas working in the field, just as for the State Department, they're recruiting a very different type of officer through their Foreign Service Officer exam. So different cultures, different recruitments. One of the things, and to propose for us to think about as we try and make both systems stronger, is that the State Department actually has a Director General of Foreign Service that leads the entire effort for the Foreign Service in the State Department, and we work in harmony with them. We don't have that within USAID. And if we're a foreign affairs agency, one of the things to really think about is having a director general within USAID that can help do everything from recruitment to assignments to retention to discipline actions, because we work in some very, very difficult places. And then finally, the other big difference when it comes to HR, and then I'm going to pass the baton to my friend and colleague Dave Eckerson, is our FSNs. Our Foreign Service Nationals within USAID, we recruit a very different talent base. They are PhDs, that I've worked with a nuclear physicist, they're doctors, they're incredibly talented people who go on to be ministers, Supreme Court justices, even presidents of their countries. So what we are trying to attract as we help countries rebuild their systems, which is ultimately the mission of development, is very different than the type of Foreign Service National that the State Department needs to achieve their mission of diplomacy. So on that note, I will pass it to you, Dr. Eckerson.
I'm not a doctor. Can you hear me? Excuse me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Look, I've been a pensioner for 3 years, and so I'm sort of been out of it for a little while. But I want to talk a little bit about one of the things we tried in the past to consolidate, and that's IT. And I don't know if any of you in the room were here when Deputy Secretary Liu and Rod Shaw, made a decision over and against some of us, but they had the data to say that if we combined our email and communication systems, we would save a lot of money and we would have harmony and coordination. So they basically made an edict, and they said that Latin America, Central America, I think first, was gonna go on to the state-led IT platform, just communication and email. And they said that they were gonna cover all the costs. And so we went into the story, into the thing, and it became very apparent that it was a difficult lift. And in fact, what was happening was when we got online to do our emails, if you ever had that experience of typing your name like Dave and then waiting for it to show up on your screen, you know that something's wrong, right? Because there's this pause. And in fact, our staff called it the Rod Shaw moment. You know, and State was committed to it, and they rolled. They said it was going to roll out in Africa, and all the African missions came in and said, no, please, no. And it became very clear that it wasn't going to work. So before Deputy Secretary Liu left, they made an agreement between him and Raj that they weren't going to continue it, and Deputy Secretary Liu would leave, and it would just go away. And it did. Now, what do we learn from that? And when you look at it, and I asked a friend the other night about, you know, what was it that went wrong? And it was fascinating because with AID, we're on Gmail, right? We're on the cloud. And we wanted to preserve that when we went into the merger with State. And they tried to do it. But State Department is controlled by diplomatic security. And diplomatic security wants to have these huge firewalls. And their theory is, got a huge firewall, protect everybody inside. Well, because they had huge firewalls everywhere, when our communication was going around, it was bouncing off the firewalls so much that it was giving us that delay. So I just want to say that, you know, we talked about what could work here and what could work in this communication thing. They could do it again. But there's a problem because if you store your stuff on a cloud, which DS doesn't want you to do, diplomatic security doesn't want you to do, you know, your document is stored in several different places. A part of it is in one place and it's encrypted, and other places it's encrypted. The State Department, you got to tunnel through in the firewall. And if anybody tunnels through that firewall, they get at everything. But if you get into the cloud, maybe you're only going to get a seventh of a document. That's a fundamental difference between state and aid right now. And that's and it goes down to the contractors that work for state or Microsoft. The folks that are working with us have to deal with the cloud. So you've got competing entities in terms of the support staff. But if you could pull it off, then you could pull it off. And if we could be satisfied and we could have that cloud and not bounce one in firewalls, then you could have savings if you had the same contractor working both sides of the equation. Because every time there's upgrades, patches, you pay both sides, you know, State Department contractors and aid contractors, to put a patch on. Same thing with financial management. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it on IT. For HR, you know, what Susan said is interesting, because the counselor position that we both held, you know, you're sort of representing the senior foreign, you're representing all the Foreign Service before the political folks had come in. Your job is to represent the Foreign Service. Yet our HR director, who deals with state HR, is like the head of an office. And as counselors, most of the time, 50% of my time, I was dealing with personnel issues. And since I had run HR before, I probably dealt with more than you did. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you had the gravitas of, if you said that the counselor of aid is now also the DG of aid, the director general of aid, then you've got a certain amount of gravitas at the level of the agency to deal with the level of state's director general. That partnership or that dialogue could be very useful even in the interagency, because once a year, the director general calls together all foreign service agencies and they talk about an agenda about, you know, all the issues at hand. Well, if we were there at the same level of the DG and we were saying, let's have more, like maybe four times a year we meet, then I think that you could have a lot more harmony. Because with it, what you have to figure out is, in HR, there are functions, back office functions in HR that are the same in state and the same in aid. And if you could figure out and agree on what those were, and if you could form, if you will, state aid teams by, you know, organized by countries or whatever, I think you could come up with ways where you could probably save on personnel costs and increase harmony across the board, because everybody's got to get a cable sent out. If I'm going out to the post, somebody's got to send a cable to me to the post, and it's going to be coordinated between state and aid. So I'll stop there, and we can take questions. And at some point, we should talk about financial management. Maybe you can, because
before I get the Dave, let me just take advantage of you having the floor for a second and just push a little bit further on this issue of FSNs and human resources in general. I think about the world that we're in today of 2017 and the world we're going to have in 5 or 10 years. My view is we're going to have dozens of countries that are middle-income countries, then we're going to have a whole bunch of fragile and failed states, and AID is going to be dealing with both of those. Doesn't that say something about the kind of HR systems or the kinds of things that we're going to need, A, and then B, just talk about FSNs a little bit more in terms of how we use FSNs and how we need to take advantage of the fact AID has this unique relationship with FSNs that state doesn't?
Well, our development mission depends on professionals that know their areas of expertise. So we hire doctors. We hire engineers. And the State Department basically hires a low level of FSN. They're sort of administrative folks. So you have a constant dialectic between us trying to make sure that our classification of our jobs can give us the people that we need, versus the State Department, which in some respects have a certain amount of control over HR. And when you get to an embassy, who sometimes don't appreciate the complexity of the jobs we need or the need for a higher classification. There's been a constant problem with that all along. But when you look at all the different categories of hiring that aid has as we go into the next decade or so, there's always been a problem that we have, I don't know, you said it earlier, 28 plus classification categories. We have that because we need to have ways to bring people in, and we don't have the ability to increase our direct hire staffing. So we can use program funds, which we get a lot of, and we use those program funds to hire the people we need. And as a result, we have a lot of different categories to pull people from a lot of different disciplines. Clearly, it would be great if we could reduce the number of categories because, you know, when you're an aide, if you're a direct hire, then you're at the top of the totem pole. If you're a fellow from whatever, you're at the bottom of the totem pole, and it breeds this class system that really sucks. And if you're a senior manager, to see, you know, your personal services contractor who's been in the country for 20 years, who's an expert, knows everybody in the ministry of whatever, and they're being put down by a junior officer who is an FS, Foreign Service Rank 3, it's terrible. And so somehow you got to get through that. That's not more of a state aid thing. That's an aid thing on our part to harmonize what we do.
Fair enough. Thank you. Tim.
Make the light. I'm trying to. There. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Good. My name is Tim Beans. I used to be the director of contracts for USAID for a number of years. And during my tenure at USAID, it was during the George W. Bush administration. Condoleezza Rice was Secretary of State. And there was, everybody at USAID would probably agree that there was a concerted effort by the State Department to kind of absorb USAID. And at the time, yeah,
2005, 2006.
That's fine. So at the time, I went over and worked with my talented colleagues at the State Department to take a look at moving the procurement systems together and how we could combine them. And I took a look and went through everything that they were doing, and they were doing some good work. But basically what I saw is they were doing mostly grants. They were doing a lot of PIOs, they were doing cost type grants, they were doing program contributions, and it was nothing like we did at USAID. We were working on multi-million dollar 5-year deals, doing indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts, leaders with associates, very complex contracts. So the people at the State Department were even shocked. They said, my God, we don't do anything like this. And I said, well, look, if we have to come up with a solution, if we have to come up with a solution and save money, if we get this new system, and at the time we were working on a system called GLASS, which is the Global Acquisition and Assistance System, which now is how USAID does all their procurements. Everything must go through GLASS, even modifications, no-cost extensions, whatever. GLASS is now tied into our Phoenix and our financial system. So every single thing that goes in through this system and goes to contracts is tracked through our financial system. At the end of the report, the Office of Federal Procurement Policy has mandated that reports be sent on the acquisition and the assistance side to various different organizations that accumulate all this data to report to Congress. The system automatically shoots out that information to those organizations. So it works very well. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect, but it has gotten much better. Since I left the agency, as a result of our desire in USAID to approve our ability to report to Congress on our results, USAID traditionally had problems reporting out on how well they did. They were very good in the health arena. They could talk about vaccinations and number of children saved. It was a lot harder in democracy and governance, economic growth, education. It was very difficult for us to say, when Congress would say, we gave you X number of billions of dollars, what did you accomplish? We were not particularly good at it. But over the years, we've gotten better and better at reporting out. There is now new requirements for administrative contracting officers and contracting officer representatives coming out of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. They have now mandated requirements across the entire federal government that they have to meet. 12 technical competencies, 14 business competencies. They have to have mandatory training. So USAID has been trying to train up their technical staff that are overseeing these big contracts. And it's been a big effort, but they're doing well. People are getting certified and able to oversee these big contracts. When people talk about FSNs, I had the pleasure of starting my career with DOD. I was a Secretary of the Navy intern in procurement and contracting. They sent me to grad school. I worked major systems acquisition, big contracts. I left DOD to go to the FAA because at the time they were doing the largest civilian contract ever let, which was a replacement of all the air traffic control systems in the country. It was huge. I went out into the private sector for a while, ran a couple companies, went back, and USAID took me back in from the private sector. So I came in as a contracting officer. My first overseas assignment was Honduras. And I go over there and I say, the FSNs basically trained me as a contracting officer. They forgot more than I knew about USAID contracting. These people had 15, 20 years of experience. I was recently down in Central America. I saw some of the people that I used to work with. I went over to El Salvador. Many of the FSNs had 25 years in contracts, were getting ready to retire. The same in Guatemala. So our FSNs, I think David's right, are used very differently than State Department uses their FSNs. Now, if I were given the assignment, could I make USAID and state's procurement systems work together? And could I do it in such a way that I save the taxpayers money and it makes sense? I would tell you yes. I believe I could do it. I could figure out a way to do it. But if you were to ask me, well, what would be your way right now from just what I know, given what we've got at USAID and the way that we track everything that goes through our systems, and State Department's basically doing grants, I would say, very honestly, State, I'll tell you what, we can take over all your grants and we'll do them for you. We'll track them through our system because of the way you number your procurements. Our Phoenix system would be able to set it aside and know it's coming out of State Department. And we'll work with the Phoenix people to add additional, to make some changes to the system so that we're tracking your money. Interestingly enough for me, when I went over, one of the big concerns I had was how do you guys track your money? Because for us, it's critically important. We get program money and we get OE money. And we get soft earmarks and hard earmarks that we have to track. So we are very, very conscious about tracking the money and making sure we've got it. We've also got 2 years to obligate money. And generally speaking, if you take a look at what's happened traditionally over the years, Congress does not have a budget set for 1 October. We're under a continuing resolution. And many of the people that are out in the field running the money are very reluctant to start spending until they know how much they're going to get or in what areas. So they have the authority to move the money, but they sit back and they hold their cards tight to the chest until they see what happens, which puts our procurement system in a lot of trouble. The when State and I were looking at our systems, I think the thing that kind of came in between and stopped me from continuing was, if you remember, the president sent Colin Powell up to the United Nations, said, we will not go to war with Iraq until we get a coalition of countries to agree with us. We could not do anything politically to get ready for what was going to happen. We had to sit there in the starting gates, because if we went ahead, it would look like the administration had made up the decision to go to war, and the president said, we haven't. It's got to be an agreement at the United Nations. Once that agreement was let, Congress appropriated $2.6 billion, was the first supplemental. And we had a very short time. You remember CNN was embedded with the troops going up towards Iraq. Everything was going on. We started, because we had all these large IDIQs set up in the agency, we started moving the money. State wanted it. DOD wanted it. Even agriculture came in, and they said, we can move some of the money. When the smoke cleared, USAID moved $2.2 billion of the first $2.6 billion. When the second supplemental came through, we moved the first $2 billion, little USAID. And I would go up to the administrator, Andrew Natsios, who I respect tremendously, and I would say to Andrew, you know, this is a contracting agency. And he would hate it. He'd say, no, it's not. We're a technical agency. We do. I said, Andrew, listen to me. You're never going to get enough OE to have your people out implementing projects on the ground. That's why we depend on contractors and grantees. Once they're fortunate enough to win something with aid, they're quasi-USAID employees because they're implementing for us on the ground, and we oversee how well they're doing. So can we combine contracts in state and aid? I'm sure all of us in this room, there are a lot of smart people here, we could figure out a way to do it. But because of the nature of what we do, the complexity of the work that we do, our ability to move money rapidly. I think of, I had the pleasure of being the senior DAA in the Dacher Bureau and worked for, I see Mike over here, had the pleasure of working for Mike. The kind of work that OFTA and OTI does, where they have to move very rapidly, does not easily tie in to State Department and what I saw that State does. So can we do it? Yes. I'm going to say there's a way that we could all find to do it. If you were to ask me right now, I would say it would be easier at this point in time, as of this meeting, for us to probably take over State's contracting, and we could do it for them, and we'd do a great job for them and make them look good. So with that.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, Brent, thanks for flying in to be with us today. Share a little bit about your background and so people understand where you come from.
Hello. Yeah. I guess compared to these other folks, I'm a management services delivery lifer. I never made it out of the USAID executive office. But during my career, my first experience with shared services was at in Bangkok at one of the largest embassies at the time. There were something like 500 USDH there, even in the early 90s. And we had a system called FAS, F-A-A-S. Don't ask me what that stood for, but I think services, administrative services, was the last two. It was such an obscure, complicated process that I tried to figure it out by doing a diagram that linked outputs and inputs, and I came up with something that looked like a badly spread plate of spaghetti. My next post was also a large one in Moscow. That's when the International Cooperative Administrative Support Services system was put together. We call that ICAS. I don't know how many of you are familiar with all of our terms, but ICAS is the method that the agencies overseas use to share administrative services. And it was very clear how this system worked. You could follow everything from A to Z. And it is the vehicle by which, even today, we could share and support each other overseas. It was intended to be, well, at least it was stated, to be a vehicle for the agencies overseas to subscribe to services from agencies that were able to carry them out. Now, of course, the State Department had the predominant administrative capability. At almost every location, it's certainly the largest customer. And it all one of the major innovations, I suppose, was that prior to ICAS, State actually funded all of its core administrative services. It would pay for all of the services that it had to produce, even if it was the only agency there. The rest of us got to ride on those services. So if the management counselor was negotiating reciprocity issues or setting up the compensation plan for the local employees, they had to do that whether there are any other agencies there or not. And so another agency would come in, we would ride on that local compensation plan. We would get the benefits of reciprocity without paying for anything. With ICAS, the decision was made that every agency present overseas should pay its fair share of all of the activities necessary to function in that country. And State was pushing for this, but they were also willing to tell Congress, okay, you have been giving us an appropriation to cover this ourselves. Now, we'll do a calculation and we'll figure out how much of our appropriation do you take away and spread among the other agencies overseas so that when ICAS is implemented, they have the money to pay in for those things that they were getting free before. So things tooled along for 5 or 6 years. GAO was called in to do an audit, I think in 2003 or 2004. It reviewed the situation. It had some good things to say about ICAS. It had some bad things to say about ICAS. It mainly came to the conclusion, without a whole lot of detailed backup, that overall the U.S. government was saving money by increasing shared services, but that some agencies perhaps were paying more than they paid when they were independent. The next phase was that State Department got a little bit more aggressive, and particularly with USAID, more or less dictated that we would join them in housing, in motor pool, in guard services. We used to fund our own guard contracts. 3 or 4 years ago, the guard contracts were even taken away from the embassies and turned over to diplomatic security. And the budgets for those guard contracts went up about 20 or 30% in 1 year, about 3 years ago. DS let contracts on a worldwide basis. DS is diplomatic security. I happened to be in South Africa at the time, which is the home base of some of the most dynamic guard services in the world, as you can imagine. And the contract was awarded to G4S, an international company. Prices go up 30, 40%. The embassies themselves, the State Department itself had very little say. The embassy post, I mean, not the State Department. The management at the embassy had very little to say about that. That contract was handed out. Overall, I believe expenses have gone up because the State Department tends to have more American staff in management positions. They come along with housing. They come along with 3 or 4 children that have to be sent to school. And it just goes on and on. In USAID, we were much more dependent on our local staff. An example would be in Pakistan, where we had something like 250 residential leases managed by our FSN, our local employee leasing agent, and maintained by our staff of local general services staff. No Americans other than the two of us that were at the top of the management section in USAID. The State Department on the other side would have a management counselor, a deputy management counselor, a supervisory general services officer, 2 assistant general services officers, all coming with housing, education, and so on.
I was going to say, and a partridge in a pear tree.
And a partridge in a pear tree. Now, I still believe that ICAS is a very well-constructed vehicle. It needs to be operated more transparently. It needs to be used on a voluntary basis when people on the ground believe there is a benefit to all for them to use that vehicle. Do some studies. It's a good product. You can do all kind of what-if scenarios using this software. You can come down to the last penny to see what difference it will make to every person that's participating in a service. Unfortunately, compared to the early days when any agency that wanted could get a program of the software put up on their own computer and they could get a download of the database and play with it themselves, nowadays, it's completely within the confines of the embassy's financial management office. And unless you somehow have figured out how ICAS works and know what questions to ask, it's very difficult to find out what's going on in those systems. I've been retired for 10 years, but they call me back quite regularly. I've been to about 22, 23 different missions in the last 10 years. And it's very rare that I go in and look at that ICAS system and I don't see something pretty funny going on there. But I still stand up for the software. It's a good program, and if we as other agencies get our business underhand, we can go places with it. This is another place where I believe the loss of USIS was devastating because they also had executive officers with years and years of management experience. We lost another agency that would have helped to be a counterbalance to the efforts to take on more services on behalf of the State Department.
So, Brent, are you in favor of some kind of an audit for ICAS? And if so, what does that mean?
It would be useful. Okay. Another place I was Egypt. Just as I was leaving Egypt, State Department proposed four pilot projects. There are something like 33 different service areas in ICAS. They proposed a pilot project in four of those service areas where USAID would take on, say, the motor pool, state would take on warehousing. I don't know what the other two were. And at the end of the pilot period, the relative benefits of one agency versus the other taking it on would be evaluated, costed out, and so on. I didn't see the results, but my successor as executive officer in Egypt told me that, well, they got to the end of the pilot period and the State Department just took over all four areas without particularly going into depth. The GAO audit in 2004 did not really do a before and after examination of the overall government costs or individual agency costs.
Sorry, Brent, sorry to interrupt. What was the GAO report that you're referring to? It was on this topic, on ICAS?
It was specifically on ICAS. I believe it's the only GAO audit that's ever been specifically on ICAS. They've done annual reports on government efficiency, and usually something gets mentioned on ICAS, but it's one small item among government-wide subjects.
Brent, would you do some kind of an audit? That's been mentioned as something that people think ought to be.
I think it would be, as far as I know, there have never been a good, solid financial audit of ICAS that would compare before and after situations, that would look at the way costs are distributed under ICAS. There are several ways under ICAS that a budget is drawn up. Number one, they decide what they need to do. Number two, they project which agencies are going to take how much of things. And number three, they assign a percentage of each employee's time as to how it's allocated among providing one of these, any number of these 33 different services. So if you get, you know, when you're in the motor pool, 100% of your time is the motor pool, or maybe 80% of motor pool is motor pool and 20% is vehicle maintenance. If you get into at the level of the management counselor, now the management counselor may have his 100% divided across 25 different areas. I would love to see the audit include an examination of the allocation of the management counselor's time to some of the more nebulous cost centers. There's something called basic package, which every agency must subscribe to overseas, and it covers things like, let's see, I wrote a few of these down. Diplomatic accreditation, reciprocity negotiations that I mentioned before, publishing embassy policies, check-in and check-out procedures, issuing ID badges, allowance surveys. There are about 17 of these. I've rarely seen any location where the management counselor doesn't say he or she spends 2 hours a week working on these things. 2 hours a week, issuing ID badges. It's a real job for the management counselor. But that has largely been unquestioned, and you will also find that it's on down the line. The general services officer, the HR officer, they all plug in all kinds of time against that basic package. That's a cost center, as they call it, that every agency is required to subscribe to, and it's the one that spreads the cost most widely. So time allocation issues, I don't think there's ever been a substantial time and management study either. That should be part of the audit. When I actually served at a post as a contractor where USAID was managing the ICAS services, we were in Almaty, Kazakhstan. The embassy had recently moved to the capital, which was 800 miles away. It left DEA, CDC, and FCS behind. USAID had a substantial management capability. So we started managing an ICAS program there. And where was I going with that? Yes. No, I've lost my train of thought.
So I think, Brent, I think the moral of that story is if AID is going to play a management role or be engaged, it needs to bring capable people to participate in those sorts of activities. That was, I think, the point of one of the things. I want to just thank you, Brent, very much. Susan, while I have you here, I want to just get you to reflect on what you heard, and then I want to open it up. So
great.
Can I ask you that?
Yeah, just one thing I was going to bring also Brent's story to life on why it doesn't matter who manages Motorpool, and it gets back to the FSNs. As who manages these services also has certain rules and restrictions. Our FSNs travel with us everywhere. So when we're going to the airport at 4 in the morning, they're allowed to jump in our motor pool. Embassies have different restrictions on that. And all of a sudden, we're paying double the cost. So this point about having an audit of ICAS to really look at costs, but also services. Because when the services aren't provided, they are just the cost goes up in a different way, which ultimately comes back to the U.S. taxpayer dollar. So that, and then the last point I wanted to make was related to the HR and where we serve, as Dave talked about as well. We're obviously not going to be in Paris and London and some of the other lovely places. We're really where stress is incredibly high constantly. And so the stress and resilience assessment and work that's been done within USAID, that is an opportunity right now to move that forward, that it's not going to get the same attention state, because once they serve in these tough places of Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places, they then can go off to do another tour. So again, different cultures, different places where we serve.
I caught back up with my train of thought.
Okay.
In Kazakhstan, we also, in the USAID executive office, we had responsibility for supporting our employees in 4 other countries in the Central Asia. And so it would not be right for me to say that 100% of my time was involved in delivering services to the consulate in Almaty. So we put in 25 or 30%. What I'm saying is, with the management counselors, I haven't ever seen any location where the management counselor isn't saying that 100% of his or her time is devoted to delivering these 33 services. All that time they spend in the front office with the ambassador, the DCM, they're always talking about motor pool services and housing, and I don't know. I've never been in on that meetings, but I think a GAO could ask to sit in and see what's going on.
Good. All right, I want to hear from some folks out here. There's no such thing as a free public event with me, so I want to get people working here. This woman here, we're going to bunch questions together, so this is your moment if you want to ask a question. It's now. Otherwise, I got plenty of questions for this panel. So this woman here, anyone else? This gentleman here, anyone else? Going, and Byron Radcliffe, and Mike Hess, those 4, okay? This person, Byron, and Mike. Go ahead.
Ann Posner, question from AFSA. My question is, first thing, when there is any kind of an audit done, should it not take into account the present hiring freeze on eligible family members? Because that's definitely making an impact on the cost, too. Because besides FSNs, there's a difference when you're hiring people who are already in country and you already have the packages and so on. So I think this is a great idea for an audit, but also take a look at the effect of the eligible family hiring.
This gentleman here. I was going to support Brent's comment.
Do you want a mic?
Yeah. Irving Rosenthal, former mission director, particularly in Africa. And I know from Africa, between aid and state, let's be honest, man to man, woman to woman, it's not one-on-one. The joint motor pools in many African places, State Department people low down in the ranks always get priority over senior people in aid, such as mission directors. The other thing is, in the good old days, State Department was one place, and aid was someplace else. It was absolutely different. The local people knew that embassies were working for the U.S. government, but in the back of their mind, they knew that the aid people were working for them, and there was a much more close relationship. Then when they moved, you said, into the State Department, into the embassy, and built a wall around it, that really destroyed the kind of direct relationship that aid had with most of the people. So I think the distinction between the culture of state and aid, the kind of work that aid and state do, must be recognized. You know, an ICAS may sound like efficient, but it isn't.
You need to all bring out your crystal balls for a second. On the point of, you've all given some very key, really efficiencies or very good areas that aid has over state or vice versa. The report's gone to OMB about efficiencies and redesign and restructure. What do you think are the three or four, you know, since it was generated supposedly by staff, what are the three or four points they suggested that should be redesigned in contracts or HR? What do you think are those key points from their perspective now that have gone in the report that has to be addressed?
Thank you. Mike Hess, formerly USAID. A couple of points, and one of them I remember when we were going through this back in the day, somebody made the great statement, tying two rocks together doesn't ensure they float. So mergers don't always work, and we got to analyze them, and I think your points are well taken. But my real key concern were the different hiring mechanisms. We had 23 separate hiring mechanisms in the DACHA Bureau. Every one of those people had different benefits, and it was tragic because when they would lose their contracts, they would lose their paid vacation, they would lose all this stuff. But more importantly, when they came back from overseas, they didn't get the care that they needed, the mental health and all the services they could get to take. And we have to fix that to take care of our people better.
Objections to the comments, we'll go on the line. Susan.
Okay, well, Anne, first, thank you very much for raising the question of EFMs. The eligible family members are absolutely critical, not only to every post, because unlike, you know, maybe 50 years ago, where you didn't necessarily have EFMs who came with a whole professional background, today we do. We did 20 years ago and 25 years ago, and I felt fortunate to have a family that where both of us were appreciated, and I was really disheartened to hear that EFMs, this happened when I was still in USAID, my last week, as a matter of fact, we had the acting director general come over and say, you know, unfortunately, EFMs cannot be hired, they're under the freeze, but we can hire your kids as summer interns. And we just laughed and said, so the kids can start supporting us now. But it's very, you know, it's really upsetting that 6 months on, that was 6 months ago, a little bit more, that we're still in this situation, because it not only affects the ability for our embassies to take on more work, and this is cross-state and USAID and all services, but also it's a huge morale issue. I mean, our partners who go out with us on these excursions, you know, they deserve to have just as fulfilling, and we need them. So I that is my plea. I agree. I mean, not just an audit. I think there needs to be attention to that, as well as to probably what many of you read in the Washington Post today. It was very good to see that there was attention brought to our family members who have children with disabilities or who need special, who are special needs. That is something we should be giving them the same opportunity to serve, and that's clearly not happening. And I think this again relates back to what our officers and families are going through today, and that we're not doing enough to really support them in these incredibly stressful environments. And not just, again, getting back to what Dave said, it's not about Foreign Service, PSCs, GS, no, everybody who's serving in these environments and their families. And we have a lot, we need to put a spotlight on this because we're not meeting our care of duty. And if this was happening over at DOD, there would be an outcry. But it's happening within State Department and USAID, and we're just not getting the attention. So that would be my plea. So thank you for raising that. As far as, you know, Byron, great point about what are the key points and what are the things. I'm actually not going to talk about backroom functions, but something else that You know, they did propose moving forward. It's in the all the consensus reports, and I think it's one of the most important things for this administration to move forward to, and that is strengthening and bringing together policy, strategy, and budget. Because we've seen when they've been disconnected, and this is both within USAID and State Department, when policy, strategy, and budget are not a strong foundation within both diplomacy and development, we end up doing a lot of stupid things, which is what Dan's trying to help us not do. So I hope that moves forward. And then, yes, on the hiring mechanisms, absolutely, Mike, something we were talking about beforehand. That comes down to us having more OE, as you know, and
operating expenses.
And I remember meeting with the Senate Appropriations Committee many, many times over the last several years, both the majority and the minority, and they want to support us in this. This administration has an opportunity to help because we'll save money. And there were a lot of different folks who would love to be able to convert into full-time foreign service or civil service. And, you know, or I'd love to go back to the days where we're separate, but those days are so long gone. It's you know, so our challenge is how do we become as operational as possible while living within these fortresses?
You know, General Hess, one of the things that we tried to
He's
do,
Dr. Eckerson, so.
if you all know about Foreign Service Limited, you know, we got that authority. If you, anybody remembers Charlie Flickner, when we said we've got all these cats and dog categories, Flickner said, well, we'll give you a new authority so that you can start bringing people in. So we got the Foreign Service Limited. To me, the Foreign Service Limited employee had been just scandalized because it was to put people in places like Iraq and Afghanistan so that we could have the people that we were required to put out there, and they were Foreign Service officers. Now you look, and it was only to be used overseas, and we were going to have just a little bit that was going to be in Washington. Well, you look at where the FSLs are now. They're all in frickin' Washington. And I could go so far as to say they've almost been politicized, but I won't. I'll just leave it out there. But still, Susan's right. You want to do it right, you get more operational expense money, and you just broaden the categories. We're always going to have need of folks in country. But still, it's not good to have the categories we have. And what do you do? You know, I mean, in terms of where are those areas where you can have convergence and sort of, you know, I would say, as much as people have been hammering on ICAS, there's potential there if you do an audit and you do it right, that you could sort out roles and responsibilities, because it still is a way, it's a system that is bringing us together on a lot of fronts. I think the second thing, you're not going to do anything with financial management. We are both on the same platforms, by the way, a momentum. And state built its financial management system on top of it to serve their needs, which is mostly you know, what they do. And we have a very complex thing built on the top of ours. And a lot of people say that that's enough. We use the same software. The problem is that when you put a patch on that software, then state's got to do its pushes, its patches out, and aid's got to push its patches out, and it's the same damn software, momentum. I think in IT, I think there are areas. I think it's a political issue in terms of the way state wants to manage its IT.
Small political issue, like internal politics.
It's internal politics. It's frankly the way they want security. And so that's an issue that I don't know if it's going to be won or not, but clearly, in my simple understanding of it, I would think it would be a lot safer to be in the cloud than underneath a firewall that could be vulnerable. But that's...
Hey, Tim. Hmm.
Yeah, I think David and Susan have talked a lot about the 23 different hiring mechanisms. I don't think it makes sense. Anything that we can do as between both organizations that can make it simpler and fairer for individuals so people aren't treated differently and save money for the agency should be done immediately. Byron, as to your point, I don't know that there's a really easy fix procurement-wise between state and aid. They really do have very different, both of them do what they do well. I think we do development well, state does diplomacy well. I don't think the two, in my experience, match up really closely. I really do think they're, just like I think DOD does what they do well, but it's not, they do procurement just like other agencies. But I think there's a distinction there. If someone can show me a way where we can combine and make it work smoothly for both organizations, and It's cost-effective. I don't want to do anything. I can put systems together and spend a ton of money, and it costs us more, and it's not as effective. And I've seen it done, unfortunately, in my tenure with the government. But if I can find a way to save money and both organizations can get what they want, I would be all for it.
To Ann's point, the one thing about family member employment that you didn't mention is how unevenly it fell on different embassies, depending on what cycle of the assignment process family members were in. Some missions lost three or four of their top four or five significant EFM positions, I guess they were losing it this past summer. Others, if they were more fortunate, they wouldn't lose it until next year. So it was very uneven in its impact across the world. Some functions we could combine more easily if state were willing to do for our implementing partners some of the things that we have to do for them, because right now they're not eligible for embassy services. We typically have our own bilateral agreements with foreign countries, and those convey for implementing partners some of the same privileges that diplomatically accredited people get, like customs, import of household effects, and so on. If the embassy is not prepared to draw that into the coverage of its customs and shipping department, we still have to maintain probably one quarter to one half of an employee that develops the expertise on that. And that's certainly not efficient to have one person spending a quarter of their time doing something that could easily be folded into an embassy shipping section. And one more thing on all those different categories of employees, the complications that creates overseas. Are they eligible for shared services if they're a fellow or a third-party contractor that works within your mission? What kind of diplomatic accreditation do they get or not get? What color badge do they get? We've done a very poor job of defining that from the center where these contracts or fellowships are managed as well.
Okay, please join me in thanking the panel.